February 3rd, 1985, sitting in the office of Lou Rosenblum talking about the good old days. When were you born?
1918.
Where?
February 1918, on Youngstown, on Prospect Street, on the east side.
How long did you live there?
We lived there probably for about 2 years, and then my parents moved to Albert Street, where my brother was born, 3 years after I was. And eventually, and then we moved up onto Oak Street, kept going further
east,
and we lived there for probably another, maybe 4 or 5 years. Finally moved to Truesdale Avenue at Oak Street, and we lived there up till about 1956. Actually, my parents lived there. I didn't. And then my mother sold the house about then. She remarried. But all my years up till the time I was about 20, probably about 23 or 4, was spent in that area.
What school did you teach?
I started at Lincoln School in kindergarten, went to 6th grade, and I went to East High School. And went from junior high to graduation, high school graduation.
Mm-hmm. What kind of neighborhood was Albert Street?
Albert Street was pretty much, I would say, a predominantly white
residential.
Residential, yeah.
Like that?
No, they, in fact, my parents didn't live there too long. I lived in, there was a row of flats, apartments and flats, behind other houses that were on the Albert Street.
Were there any Jews there?
I don't remember whether or not there were Jews right on Albert Street there, but I knew there were quite a few Jewish people on the east side of Youngstown who
lived. You said quite a few, can you hazard a guess? What percent of the population of Youngstown?
Well, I would estimate, I don't know what the population of Youngstown was, but I would have to estimate that there are probably at least 100 families, Jewish families, scattered on the east side, starting down at Hines Street and Prospect Street had probably a greater concentration of Jewish people than maybe any other particular street. And we're talking about 1918 to about 1925, perhaps.
Did you go out to Sharon Line? And
there were a few out in Sharon Line.
Chadsville?
There were a number of business places, grocery stores particularly. Chaz House had a grocery store in Science Hill. There's Nathan Nickel. He had a place that used to be called Sharon Line Stops.
Yeah.
And they were out there. Trolley car ran from Youngstown to Sharon. People would get off at these various stops, and there were Jewish people living there.
Berman's, were they stop 27 or?
I don't remember the stops anymore. I know there were stops.
But the Bermans were at them?
I don't recall them. The ones I recall particularly were Chasnov's and Nickel. It was a Nathan Nickel, and it was a Harry Nickel, but I don't remember whether he lived there. And the Nickels, Nathan Nichols' parents lived on Truesdale Avenue, about a block away from where I grew up.
So there would have to be temples on the east side then?
Yes. And the two temples I remember, of course, were the Shara Torah Chesed Shalemus, which was on Himrod Avenue, just a little up from Prospect Street.
And was it a big congregation?
Yeah, I would say probably 70, 80 families at that time.
And the other one?
And the other one was a big house down on Hines Street, which also was Shara Torah. I don't remember the rest of it.
Well, where did they come from?
They came from the primarily from the east side.
No, I mean, where did the Lance Light come from originally? For the two temples?
I think they were pretty well mixed. They came from Galicia, they came from Russia.
So there wasn't an ethnic difference between the two congregations?
Not particularly, no. Not particularly. Not that I recall.
Yeah. All right, so we know where you grew up, where you went to school, public school. What about your Jewish education?
Jewish education was a hit and skip thing. Originally started out with my parents sending me to a Melamed.
Who was his name, by the way?
Well, I'm trying to remember now.
Wasn't Millen.
No. I remember a Mr. Sandel.
Yeah.
Who lived on Quinn Street, and I used to go to his house. And then there was another one that I used to go to on Fruit Street. In fact, I'm trying to remember his last name. His son, his grandson, is a lawyer, Vic Sperling. I used to go to his place, Sperling, and...
Give me your definition of a Melamed, as you see it.
Melamed to me was a man who would teach children, or boys particularly. I never saw any girls in any of these situations, but teach them how to read Ivra, how to... How to daven. It was rather inadequate because you really didn't know what you were reading. There was no interpretation, you know.
But a Melamed wasn't necessarily, in my recollection, a professional trained teacher, right?
Not an
enthusiastic amateur?
Yeah, I would say so. I think...
Usually part-time?
Yeah.
You had another job?
Well, I don't recall that these two men that I'm mentioning to you had other jobs. But they had a number of other boys who used to come there. I don't remember how many times a week. And then also went through a period when we had Hebrew school at the shul on Himrod Avenue. And as I recall, Eugene Gottesman used to teach Hebrew there.
Which shul is this one?
This is the Himrod Avenue shul. I can't remember which came first or second. Then for a period of time, I also went to the school, the Jewish Center, I don't know what you call it, Jewish Center, Jewish Hebrew School, on Lincoln Avenue. Mm-hmm. And
that's Youngstown Hebrew Institute.
That's right. I went there, I don't recall, for a couple of years, and I would say that probably the education there far surpassed anything I'd had at any of the other places. Unfortunately, I didn't go there long enough to really learn enough about it.
But you went long enough to play football out in the backyard?
Yes, indeed. Yes, indeed. And got hit by a rock in the head from the Catholic kids who came up the street from St. Columbus?
St. Columbus.
It seemed like during the time I was there, we always seemed to have stone fights. We had a big iron fence there at the place, and we end up ducking behind on Arlington there, which was the playhouse, I think. And one day I stuck my head off from behind the playhouse when I shouldn't have, and got hit with a rock in the head.
So, a lot of damage?
I think I remember going into the building, Hebrew building, and somebody putting ice and stuff on my head, huh?
Malvina Klein?
Yeah, I remember her. I remember your sister that was there, and there was a Grossman, a Mrs. Grossman that was teaching, and of course Mr. Haynes, mm-hmm. and there were a couple other people I can't remember right now, but, you know.
So what do you remember learning there?
What I remember learning there was, first of all, I learned Yiddish to...
You learned Yiddish?
Yeah, I'm pretty sure it was there. In fact, I think somewhere at home I still have the book.
I don't remember learning Yiddish, except the Firkashas that does.
No, they had a book, and it was, I've forgotten it, but I learned how to write
the vowels in script, you know, in writing, like. And we had some training in how to read and write Yiddish. Then, of course, we had the usual courses of history and of course, more davening.
Sitter,
yeah, right, studying the sitter. And I think even some Chumash we got there. In other words, to know something about it. But it was not anything that was a lot of, you know, I got it in little bits and pieces.
Well, who was the main teacher in the—
That's a good question. It seemed to me there was a man, and I can't think who it was, that was in charge of the school. Tell you what, I remember most of that building, other than the classrooms. I remember this, what must have been the boardroom there. And nobody walked in. They had a carpet in there and big chairs and so on. And as I recall, that was kind of off limits for the students. But I've heard the name Milman.
And Milman was a, I think he come from Palestine. I'm not sure. He was short, about 5 foot, maybe.
So Alexander Milman?
Right.
No?
And he used to have a favorite trick of dividing class up in half and folding his arms against his chest, and he'd try to pull his arms apart. No matter how hard you thought, you couldn't get him up right.
I don't remember that. I remember that.
It shows you different things you remember.
Yeah, but...
What about that little store down the street? Remember that?
On Elm Street?
Yeah, down by Rand. Used to get candy, and used to have the best chocolate soda.
I don't remember that. If I didn't have enough money to go down there and buy anything.
Well, I'll save money all a month to go down.
Incidentally, by the time I was ready for Bar Mitzvah, I wasn't going there anymore, and I think it was either Ernie Gossman or Jack Brown. Ernie, you remember, his father was the rabbi he was there when I was Bar Mitzvah on Himrod Avenue show. And Jack Brown, his father was Max Brown. He was like a...
Governor?
No, it's like he used to go by the name Reverend Max Brown. He wasn't a rabbi, he was a chazan, and he was kind of all-around guy. And the Browns had, I don't remember how many boys, each one, of course, well-educated, and either I or my brother studied our bar mitzvah, the laughter and the speech and that whole bit from between those two fellows. We weren't with Jack Brown and Ernie Gossman, only a few years older than what I was, but of course they had a lot of background, you know.
Do you remember any of the rabbis from?
Well, other than Gottesman, I remember the rabbi, of course I knew, on the side was Gottesman. Then, we went to Temple Emmanuel, there was a number of them, of course Rabbi Manello. I remember the rabbi was there when my father died. He went back to New York. His name doesn't come to me right now.
Before Manello?
No, that would have been after Manello. I'm trying to think.
Helfgott or something?
Yeah, that was right. Rabbi Helfgott. And then there was the one that was married, and it was all a kind of problem. He was beating up his wife or something. That was another rabbi we had there. I can't remember his name. And I can kind of see these people. But
Were you then going to Emmanuel?
Yeah.
What had happened, the Himrod Avenue show, by virtue of the fact that a lot of Jewish people on the east side continually were moving off of the east side, they were moving to the north side, other places, until it finally got down to the point where it was just a handful of people, including my father and mother, that were left. at that shul. So they got together with Temple Emmanuel, and the Hemet Avenue shul had a cemetery out in Coitsville. And at that time, Temple Emmanuel didn't have any cemetery. So a deal was struck that Temple Emmanuel would take over all the paraphernalia and so on, also exchange the cemetery over to Temple Emmanuel. And the people that were left on in the Sheratora on Hemet Avenue, they became members of Temple Emmanuel. And
when did this happen? Any rough idea?
I would have to say that happened, let's see, my brother was not bar mitzvah there, right? So that was, he was born in 1921, 13, 4. Had to be
the late 20s, early 30s.
Early 30s that that happened. And one of the things that the members who came over from the Hemet Avenue show were given life membership seats at Temple Emmanuel.
Who were some of them?
Good question. There were people, lackeys, I think, called Lakomovich at that time. It would be Bill Lackey's parents. There was a Goldbergs that lived on Murdoch Street. There was a Glassberg family, I think, that was still there. There were Combs that lived up on Garland Avenue. There were, I think some of them moved over at that time. Snyderman used to live on...
Which name?
That would be Lou Snyderman's father and Francis Snyderman's father. They lived on Shehi Street, and they were part of the thing there.
See, I'm trying to relate it to my recollection of the hierarchy. They were none of the leaders, and they didn't become leaders.
No.
They just sort of turned into the
right.
Woodwork.
That's right. Seemed for a short time. No, it didn't. I was trying to think whether or not my parents ever belonged to the Summit Street show.
Yeah, I was just going to ask you about Summit. You mentioned two temples, you didn't mention Summit.
That's right. My parents didn't belong there.
And well, the Sheratora was Orthodox, right?
Yeah.
And so was the other Sheratora?
Yeah.
Well, Summit was Orthodox.
Yeah.
By the time you moved across to Emmanuel, it was still Orthodox.
Yes, yes. Yeah, the one was set apart from the men.
On Rand Avenue.
On Rand Avenue, was on Hemrod Avenue, Hines Street, the same thing. It was strictly Orthodox. The shuls were constructed a lot like shuls in Europe, with the reader being right in the middle of the center of the floor of the room. The Oren Kodesh down at one end, but the davening was done in the middle of the room. So in other words, people.
But not Emmanuel.
No, that wasn't Emmanuel. That was both the east side shuls were built the same way.
I never understood how Emmanuel could have the Oren Kodesh on the south side.
Building was faced that way. Well, I'm trying to think. Oren Kodesh at the Hemet Avenue shul faced west.
What was on the east side then?
That was on the east
when
side.
When you faced Oren Kodesh, weren't you facing east?
You were facing west.
When you turned in facing?
Yeah. I was. You were walking up the drapes of the Oren Kodesh, you are facing west. But you see, the shul, the Hemet Avenue shul, was really a converted building. I can't tell you exactly what year they decided to, the Jews decided to take it over, because originally it was a Christian church. And they did some woodwork on the wooden benches and so on to change the crosses so that there wouldn't be crosses there. Yeah.
As you were growing up, did you ever get involved in tag days or flower days? Did you stand on the corner and push this?
No, I don't remember that. I remember remember them coming to the house, though. They just,
and they probably pick up the pushkas. Were you aware of any anti-Semitism personally or otherwise? What sort of things did you experience?
In our neighborhood where we live, used to take a lot of abuse, like at Halloween time, particularly. We seem to get the impact of all kinds of mess more than most people got.
But you knew it was anti-Semitism?
Yeah, I had reason to think so, because there were people around, not particularly on our street, but around, who would refer to us as Ikey. And I got into some fights, I remember, because of it. And one thing I remember, why I remember, I don't know, there was a kid who lived around the corner for us, and I, for some reason or another, I must have said, "Holy Moses." And he said to me, he says, "Moses wasn't holy." So, you know, it was that kind of stuff. But I would say...
Like kikes? You get kike?
I don't remember exactly kikes, but I just remember...
Christ killer or any of that?
Yeah, that kind of stuff. And
religious connected? What was the basis for the anti-Semitism?
I think primarily that we were different, we were Jews, and I'm sure a lot of it got carried over from their church teachings. You know, the Jews were an undesirable people. And but on the other hand, we had a lot of, my mother had very good friends in the neighborhood that were Italian, Irish, and so on.
Were they mostly Catholics in that area?
A lot of Catholics in that area, right. Of course, we had about the block I live in. I think there were about 4 or 5 Jewish people just on that one section of Truesdale from Oak Street up to Himron. 2 Malkoffs, Itchy Malkoff and Coleman, and I'm trying to remember who else. There were a number of other families up there. Around the corner from us was the Chudikovs lived there. So. We had quite a few Jewish people, but as a kid, I remember getting into fights over things like that.
Along about the time you were getting into your teens was when Hitler started, right? Were you aware of what was going on? Did your family talk about it? How did they react? What to your knowledge was being done in Youngstown to do something about it, you know?
Well, I know that my father, particularly, and I can remember this in the early 20s, talked to his brothers and sisters and wrote them in Europe to get them to come here. And only one of his sisters came, and the rest of them didn't want to.
Why did he come?
He came because, first of all, he had 2 cousins in New York that he was close to, and they used to write back and forth quite a bit. And the situation in Europe was he had to go into the army, and I think...
Where did he come from?
It was Hungary, originally. Then after the First War, it became known as Czechoslovakia, which I think probably it is now, too. But he had the feeling that it was he would have a better life in the United States than what he had in Europe. And I think his cousins encouraged him.
But it wasn't the pogroms and the persecution?
No, they really were not affected by that much. In fact, the matter, my mother, who also comes out of Hungary, her father was like the village constable. He was like the policeman in that village, you know. So you know that they got along pretty well. I guess there were some anti-Semitic stuff that were there, but it wasn't rampant.
Nothing official.
Right.
Okay, so then when you left high school,
yeah,
Where'd you go to college?
I went to, well, first I went to work at the store at Strauss. I did that within about three,
downtown
4 weeks.
Youngstown.
Yeah, in downtown Youngstown. That was 1936, and I just turned 18. And I was there, I worked there, of course, and didn't work anywhere else. And I think about, you know, I started there in 36, it must have been 37 or so. I started going to Youngstown College, which was known as Youngstown College, and I went to night school.
It was just one building.
Yeah.
Jones Hall.
Right, it was one building. And the teachers I had were, for the most part, people who were, had their own businesses during the day. For instance, for English and literature, I had Dr. Reed, who used to be the superintendent of Youngstown Schools. Right. When I took up commercial law, I had a Judge Carter who practiced law. Was a judge somewhere, I think, in Trumbull County. And in accounting, I had a man by the name of Atkinson who was an accountant during the day, and he taught accounting at night. I'm trying to remember who else I got. But most of the so-called professors were people who, that wasn't their whole thing. And I think particularly in the night school classes, a lot of professional people would teach.
What was the what was the population of Youngstown State, Youngstown University, Youngstown College?
About 1,500 people all told, between night schools and day classes,
part-timers.
It runs my mind is around 1,500. And they also used a couple of buildings for some classes of music on Wick Avenue.
Rand building, the old Rand High School.
Yeah, that's right, old Rand High School. That's right. I think, I think Harold Rubin used to teach engineering down there as a part-time thing also. In other words, he worked for Republic Rubber during the daytime, and it runs my mind that he had his master's when he came out of the Navy. He was graduated from...
Let's go back to the war.
Yeah.
You went to Youngstown after the war or before the war?
Oh, that was before the war, yeah. I didn't go all the way. I went 2 years, and then what started to happen is I got more and more involved. You know, with
yeah.
Oh. All right. Is this thing going now?
Yeah.
Well, I went to school for about two years, and that time, then I started getting more involved at the store. I was beginning to take on responsibilities, and I was doing some correspondence course work, and as a result I didn't continue on with the college thing. At the time I felt that the more time I spent on the job I was on would further me along. I was encouraged by the management at Strauss at that time.
Who did you deal with?
Well, C.J. Strauss, of course, was the president of the company.
Did you get to know him personally at all?
Yes. Yes, I did.
Can you describe him?
Well,
thumbnail
yeah,
profile?
C.J. was an impressive man, and you had the feeling when you came into his office that you were coming into a place where there was a lot of power, and he was the kind of a person that warmed up to you very quickly. And
was he very formal, was the impression I had?
Tend
to talk good.
I didn't talk to him that much, but the times that I did talk to him, I mean, weren't formal like. I mean, it would have to do with perhaps something I was doing in the store, and he would at times be helpful to me with regarding perhaps if I had problems with certain people that were giving me a hard time, he would come into that. And of course, the other man in the company was right next to him, was George Thompson. So, but you didn't see those people on a kind of regular basis. You just see them walking through. So if you got called up for some reason that they were going to change you to a different area, a different department, stuff like that.
But who'd you report to other people?
Well, in the beginning, I reported, the first job I had, I reported to the man that was a buyer of curtains, drapes, and floor covering.
Uh-huh.
A man by the name of Hayes. I can't remember what his first name was. And he was a tough man to get along with. He had a sixth grade education himself. But he was a hell of a businessman, and he produced a lot of profit for the company. But he was certainly not what you'd call a polished kind of a person. And I practically left when I was with him. And it was Mr. Strauss who one day, I must have said, next person in power to Strauss in the store.
Gerald Myers?
Gerald Meyer was in the brand stores at that time, and he really didn't have much to do with downtown at that time either. Of course, you got to remember in those days, the board of Strauss's was probably mostly family. The Myers, the Einsteins, Hartzell's.
Was Hartzell in it?
Well, yeah, Hartzell was Hirschberg. That's where that was the original Hirschbergs. Mm-hmm. Dr. Hartzell.
Well, can you tell me anything about Hirschberg? Nobody seems to know.
Well, the only thing I remember of Hirschberg, I remember as a little kid coming into the store, and I think I used to see him on the floor in the store. I used to, and they were.
Was he just a friend of Strauss's? How did they get together?
No, they got together. They had a partnership when they started the business in 1875 or so. It was called the Little Woolen Store or something like that, mm-hmm. down on Federal Street. And Isaac Strauss and Bernard Hirschberg were the founders of the store, the small store. And later on, they expanded that building, and they don't recall whether they went up the street or where, but then they went back towards Commerce Street, and there used to be two buildings. You came in on one on Federal Street, and you walked through an alley, and you went to the second, was later known as the Schwing-Wagner Building. That was what I remember of that. Of course, by the time I came to the store was as it is now. Not as big as it is now, but it was already built. I think it was built in 1920.
They expanded to Belt.
Yeah, that's right. Well, they expanded a number of ways. They went, the store was originally six floors high with a basement store. They expanded up at least two more floors going up, and then they went behind what is now the Wick Building, and that was a lot of shops and stores there on Fell Street, and they eventually took all of that over. And when they put in the escalators, that's really where the escalators were put, was on the Phelps Street addition on that side.
Right where it connected.
That's where it connected, right. And it got up to, I'd say that originally the store might have been about maybe not 300,000 square feet in total. And then when they got through that, it was close to 500,000 square feet, where they had all this stuff on. Of course, now they're going to reverse.
All right, and I want to ask you to put a little more flesh on C.J. Strauss, some personal insights, his family, his character, his...
Well, you got to remember, that my period of time with him started when I came to the store in 1936 when I was a $9 a week stock boy. And as a $9 a week stock boy, you weren't talking to the president of the company very often. The only times I would see him as he walked through the store. Later on...
Was he always immaculate?
Yes, yes.
Well-dressed?
Right. I mean, he had on whatever was the latest thing in clothing, men's suits or ties or shirts, you know. He was, and I remember him also wearing a black coat with a velvet collar with a derby, black derby. In fact, it seemed like both Thompson and he wore almost identical clothes. Mm. If they were wearing a derby, they both wore a derby. They were wearing a black, some kind of woolen coat with a velvet collar, which was a vogue then, they both wore it. C.J. Strauss, a couple of years after I started, I was kind of in a somewhat of a training program. And at that time, when you were in the training program, you got invited to the Friday morning meetings, the buyers and so on. And usually, C.J. Strauss was the one that conducted that meeting. Well, he was a real showman. I mean, I'll never forget this one meeting we had. He was trying to demonstrate the frustration that the customer has when we were out of stock. So he went through this whole bit of using the customer's words and the salesperson's words of how the customer asked for a pair of gloves and the salesperson is pulling out boxes and drawers all over the place and can't find the customer's size. And the customer's getting exasperated. And his point was, how important it was to the buyers and the people involved, that you had to be in stock all the time. And when a customer came in, if she wanted an oddball size, you should have it. But he would do this like show business, you know. And I can remember at times, too, when things didn't please him, that he would sound off pretty well and everybody got the message. He had a lot of respect in the store. People really looked at him with a lot of respect.
When he got the message across, did he do it by yelling, or was it force of personality, was it selection of words? Or
I would say he would make sure, one way or another, that you got the point of what he was talking about.
He was very soft-spoken, wasn't he?
Not when he got going on something in the store that he didn't feel was right.
You mean he ranted and raved?
Not uncontrollably, but he would make enough points, you know, both by the way he talked and the way he expressed himself, that you had no doubt in your mind that he wasn't happy with that, what was going on, you know. Now, as I said, I did not sit in on any of the meetings or anything like that, and actually, when I left for the service, a man I used to see occasionally was Henry Goldstein, who was the general merchandise manager. And he was a person who was very aloof, you know. And then when I got to know him, found out he was a pretty friendly guy. That was Dave Goldstein's brother, if you remember. He died, I think, before I went into the service. And then when I came out of the service, which was like 46, I didn't see too much of C.J. Strauss because he died in 47. And
what did he die of?
He had a stroke, and he had high blood pressure. Those days, I'm sure they didn't have the medication, but he was comparatively young as everybody. He was 62.
Were you ever in his home?
I went there once. I had a date with his daughter. And that was the only time I ever went to his home.
What was his house like?
It was a huge house, you know, the one up there on Warner Road. Very impressive. And there were a lot of thing he used to do, he had a lot of acreage of land. I didn't see it, but as I remember it, I was told that most mornings before he came to the store, he had horses there. He'd get on his horse and he'd ride and cut trails with a pruning shears, make trails all through his property.
Wooded area.
Right.
Did he have tremendous garden?
I don't remember the gardens, but I do remember the fact that they had the horses and that he did a lot of horseback riding.
Well, Stanley Strauss told me about on these Friday meetings. He either came from horseback riding or they had to be over a certain time so he could go ride.
Well, that I wasn't aware of, but I remember there were Friday meetings, and he didn't. I never saw him in anything but his regular clothes, you know, at those meetings. In fact, I never saw him informally, period. Whenever I saw him, he was dressed for the, you know.
Did he have a big staff at the home, at his house?
I kind of remember a chauffeur. They used to bring him to work to the store.
Did a butler in the door?
I was only in that house once, and it was in the evening, so I really don't know. It was impressive.
Anything personal about him? You can tell me. A quick question.
Well, as I say, trying to think. I remember that meeting on the Fridays. I remember walking through the store.
Well, how about the things you heard or talked about with others? You observed.
I really did not, because of the echelon I was at, you know, I really did not get exposed to much. In other words, the buyers or merchandise managers would discuss him. As a rule, was not part of that, so I
didn't. Quite a bit.
Yeah.
Let's move on then to the war. What were you thinking? What were your friends thinking about Europe, about the war, before the draft, and during the draft, and when we got into the war? And, what were your Jewish friends saying and doing and thinking?
Well, probably a lot of what I experienced that time might have been through my involvement with ACA. I remember Harold Rubin and I, in fact, had a debate with other AGAs from other cities once at a convention, in which we debated the Simon Marks Bierstadt plan. This was a plan I believe the plan was to had something to do with the establishing of Israel as a homeland for the Jews. And I think the support coming from England, Britain. I remember that. We were, of course, real well aware at that time of Hitler. And although we didn't know at that time just exactly how big the situation was, but in the store at Strauss, we began to see people who had come from Germany, emigrated, Jewish people. I remember we had one.
They came Jews.
Yeah, I remember we had one man who was a Dutch from Germany, and he used to roll the Dynamax on wagons around the store. We had another man who ended up working in our display department. Walter Blumenthal, you remember him, he later became one of the best buyers in the store. But that's when we really began, at least I began to be quite aware of what was happening in Europe.
Were these people sort of feeling of despair, desperation, alarm, or just disturbed?
I can't remember there was a lot of alarm. All I can remember really is the fact that my conversation with some of these people and learning about them from others was that
Germany had become a very dangerous place to be. And these were people that were getting out.
Mm-hmm.
And we had quite a few of them. And by the time I left for the service, I would say there were maybe a couple dozen people from Europe that were working in the store, which I'm sure C.J. Strauss was instrumental in getting to come there to work. The various agencies, I'm sure, were contacting him, you know, a lot of people who came here totally destitute in many cases, you know.
Yeah. Well, what was your reaction, your friend's reaction, as the Sudeten Land fell in Austria and in France and Poland and all that? How did you react?
Well, I think, and particularly, I think what even started even more to getting us to feel about is when suddenly there was a draft for the service, and a number of the people that I was friends with started getting calls to be in the Army and whatever, and some of them took off and got into the Navy or the Air Force. That would have been probably about 1940. I can also remember going to the Cavalier races in 1939. And what was ominous, I think, was this huge German aeroplane with big swastikas on it, flying over the field, trailing this huge black smoke trail. It was kind of, I remember that to this day, because to me it was like something ominous ready to happen, because we already knew about Germany. They already knew about what they were doing, and there was a lot of, emotional feeling about what was happening.
Did you follow the Olympics? Just the Olympics?
I knew about it, but...
No feeling of us versus them?
Oh, I think the feeling of us versus them came particularly to those of the Jewish community. By the time I was leaving high school.
Well, what did they do about it?
I never really saw, that I can remember, anything that did it, that there was anything done about it. I really don't remember.
Did they believe it?
Well, as I said, the evidence of people coming to the United States, and particularly Youngstown, coming from Germany, made believers out of everybody. I think the fact that Germany wasn't a great place for a Jew to be, through that sense. But I don't remember any
meetings. Does it affect democracy into the world?
I'm sure that...
Globe.
I'm pretty sure that everybody felt uneasy about what was going on. But I don't remember any major thing that would stick out in my mind that anybody did about it.
Well, when you went into the Army, did you go in with a feeling that this was a Jewish problem and you wanted to help straighten it out, or was it strictly an American situation and you reluctantly went in, or?
No, I wasn't happy about going in, but at the same time, I think that it was really a world problem by that time. It was 1941-42, and so my friends were already in the service, and for my family, I know that the communication was beginning to get less and less. And so, and I think also there was a lot of apprehension on the part of my parents when Germans moved into areas where they were, where their families were. But I can't remember anything really vague. I remember the people who were German. Disciples of it. Leonard made his speech, and there was also this Nazi German. Was a German guy that taught, and that was the first guy. There were people in the United States, I remember, that were promoting
the Bund.
Remember, they were promoting.
It was stress.
I don't recall. I knew things were better. You know, the Jews were getting
But you go into the army feeling you had a mission to defeat Hitler because of what he was doing to the Jews. Did you think that you had a mission because of the threat to a democratic form of life, or did you tell him because you had to go in?
Probably a little of each. I think that in my mind, I would have felt very uncomfortable if I wasn't in the service. And people may get feel uncomfortable if you weren't in the service. The same token, I recall that I felt that this was the way it had to be. In
as a Jew or as an American?
As both. I felt an orbit democracy, you know, to live and not be taken over by Germany and the powers that this is something we don't have to be involved in.
Did you really do any intelligence
really? Service? Not really. Not really. I can't remember. I can't remember. Maybe you have part of those while I was stressed, actually. I was enlisting him for about 6 months, less than that. And then I went to OCS and I spent 3 months there. And there he certainly wouldn't say anything. And nobody would say anything, you know. I was afraid to even whisper because you could get bounced out on that, that you were saying something that was controversial. Well, I did come across some people in the service who were fairly warm feeling towards Germans. They were in our, and I remember that used to puzzle me along with me, but many others, you know, how the heck can this person be an officer in the United States Army and feel that Germany was great, you know? There were people, likely were commissioned officers who thought that Germany was on the right track. They thought Italy was on the right track. Remember that? Those people just got shot down. They had to go. It was a rock.
Going back to the genes and robots, and when over the years, you had the German Jews, the Western European Jews, who came over earliest, most of them, who considered themselves the elite culture. And then you had the advent of the East European Jews. Were you aware of the antagonism between the two? Did you sort of?
Well,
in your own words,
what I can remember is that eventually I came from people that were, and I lived among people who were primarily Eastern European Jews.
I don't
remember even living near, close by to anybody that was a German Jew. And among these people, I would hear the conversation about German Jews as being religious, as being being snobs, and really not very obvious for atheism is concerned. It was that kind of a feeling. They were an entirely different strata than the rest. And they, of course, the ones who supposedly had the polished manners and the polished personalities, or whatever you may call it, as Eastern Europeans, Jewish Europeans, were, how should I say, rough in their manner in many cases, and some cases not really as intelligent or polished as the so-called German Jews.
Very acculturated.
Acculturated, right. That's
probably
right.
Well, when a German Jew got into trouble, with the same type of business, you can be out for it. What did you do? I'm out of the way.
They were kind of doing their comeuppance the way, you know, the day
before.
And
I can
remember realizing that, well, all the things they had to integrate themselves and so on into the German society. Really didn't help them. And of course, that got repeated over and over again when
You gotta see that we're going after people who are two, three, four generations away from having any choices. Family lineage. Mm-hmm. I think that anything that would make an impression among so-called Eastern Jews, you know,
what?